This is Scott Becker with Becker's Healthcare. I'm thrilled today to be joined by a brilliant person who's also the leading sort of voice in social media in healthcare, Kevin Foe. Kevin's sort of a brilliant guy. Kevin, let me give you a moment to introduce yourself, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. Scott, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on. Scott said, my name is Kevin Poe. I'm an internal medicine physician in Nashua, New Hampshire. I've been practicing here for the last 16, 17 years now. I'm also the founder and editor of KevinMD.com, social media's leading physician voice. It's a platform where everybody in healthcare, whether you're a physician, advanced practitioner, medical student, and patient, can share their insights and stories with one another and hopefully learn from each other and improve our healthcare system. And once again, it's a pleasure to be on.
Thank you. And KevinMD and your following has become tremendous. How did you start that and develop it? And tell us a couple thoughts on that effort and sort of business and what you do.
So I started KevinMD back in the early 2000s. I believe it was 2004. And at that time, blogs in the healthcare world were just in their infancy. There were only, I would say, probably a few dozen clinician blogs. And I really didn't know what to expect. So I think it started when I shared a story about the Vioxx recall, one of the most popular drugs at that time, and wrote an article on that. And I remember a patient the next day coming in and say, Dr. Poe, I read your article on the internet. Thank you so much for sharing your advice. I feel comforted by what you had to say. And I realized then that blogs and by extension social media, they were a platform where we could really share our expertise outside of the exam room and really have some type of influence on our patients, not in a one-to-one setting, but in a one-to-many setting. And over the years, of course, it's blossomed up with many, many more social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, where we can really share expertise and correct misinformation on the web and advocate for causes that are important to us. And I think that's tremendously important now as our healthcare world is really evolving in a rapid pace.
What are some of the causes? You mentioned causes that are inspiring to people or interesting to people. What are some of the core things you're most concerned about or interested in today?
I think the most concerning thing to me is misinformation online. We are in a proverbial fake news era, certainly in other industries and in politics, and that extends to healthcare. One of the things I talk to my fellow clinicians about is how anybody can spread health information online. You don't have to be a medical professional in order to do so. With these social media platforms, it's a blessing and a curse. We have these platforms where we can share information with minimal friction, but that's also a curse because everyone can do that. And we have an epidemic of false medical information. The biggest example being that false connection between vaccines and autism. And social media is tremendously influential. So I think that it's tremendously important for medical professionals to go online, use these tools, and try to correct that misinformation that's out there that patients are reading every single day, because this type of misinformation is being propagated on various social media platforms, and we're a little bit behind the curve. So that's one of the things I implore my fellow clinicians to do is get online and either be sources of reputable health information or be filters so we can direct patients to better sources of health information.
You'd mentioned the link, you know, between vaccines and autism is one example of just lots of disinformation on the internet around healthcare, around social media. Any other things that you point to as sort of leading examples of sort of misinformation around healthcare?
That's the biggest one. I think that when we have a lot of studies that come out, there's a lot of interpretation. I think the way mainstream media reports on studies is a problem. A lot of health journalists don't necessarily have backgrounds in healthcare, so sometimes preliminary results are breathlessly reported and perhaps overstated in the media. And I think it's important to sometimes ratchet down the hype or provide some context to what's being reported, because I have a lot of patients who come to me, and it's not uncommon for them to say, Dr. Poe, I read this article on my Facebook feed. You know, what do you think about the link between you know, these two things, or what do you think about this latest study? So I think that is also another example of how medical professionals can go online and really help interpret the news that's being reported out there and help interpret the studies that are being reported, because patients are asking about this all the time.
Fantastic. And a different question about healthcare in general. The biggest problem in healthcare, cost, access, quality, or something else?
Well, I think the easy answer would be all of the above, right? I think we do have a problem with cost, access, and quality. But if I were to rank them, I would say access comes first, followed by cost and quality. Even after the Affordable Care Act, we have about 20 million plus people without health insurance. I think it's important to get these people covered. And once we have some sort of universal coverage, then we can certainly work on the cost and quality piece. I think everyone knows, and a lot of the United States, we spend more than 20% of our GDP on healthcare, and the quality suffers in these national surveys when we compare health systems with one another. So I don't think we're getting a good value for money. I think that cost is going to cripple our economy and other areas going forward. But without covering everybody first, without that access piece, it's going to be very difficult to tackle cost and quality. So if I were to rank them, it would be access first, then cost and quality.
Thank you. And let me ask you a different question. What do you see as going right in the U.S. healthcare system?
I think with our American healthcare system, we have fantastic specialist care. We have groundbreaking medical discoveries that are happening every single day. We have people coming to the United States for very specialized treatments, very complicated surgeries that no one else in the world can do. So I think that specialist care in the United States is the best in the world. So if I were to name one thing that we're strong in, it would be that.
Let me ask you a follow-up question to that. You know, similar to the autism vaccine question, what's the second thing that we're strong in?
A second thing that we're strong in, I think the strength of our medical educational system, I think it's kind of a corollary to that. I think that not only do we have great specialist care, but I think our medical education system is also second to none in the world. I do have issues in terms of the cost of medical care and medical education. I think that's a problem in and of itself, but the medical education itself is second to none. It's associated with fantastic academic hospitals across the country, and there's a tremendous variety in terms of medical education one can receive in the United States. So if that would be a second strength that we have, is the quality of our medical education.
Thank you. And along those lines, there's looming shortages of physicians in all parts of the United States. Could medical school be shorter and not impact the quality of medical school? What's the trade-off there?
So I know that there have been some medical schools that's experimenting with three-year programs versus the traditional four, specifically with primary care. So I think that medical education can be shortened, but I would not focus on medical school in itself. I think the question then becomes, do we need 4 years of undergraduate medical education to go to medical school? So I think that is something that could be shortened. In other words, do we really need 8 years in total to train a physician? And I think the answer is no. I think that we do need 4 years in medical school, but I do think that the prerequisites can be shortened. I think some of the clinical components of the first 2 years of medical school can be shifted to the undergraduate years. In fact, if you look at other countries' medical education systems, they don't have as onerous pre-medical requirements as we do here. So I think that can be shortened. So the question isn't really, should medical school be shortened from 4 to 3 years? I think the better question is, do we really need 4 years of undergraduate education prior to becoming a medical school? And I think my answer is no. I think that could be shortened. And I think that some of the non-clinical topics that's tackled in the first couple of years of medical school can be shifted to the undergraduate year, so we can have more time in medical school focusing on clinical aspects of care.
Fantastically interesting perspective, and appreciate it. Next thought, one of the common things in the news right now is price transparency. How important is that? Not important? Any thoughts on the price transparency effort?
So I think price transparency is important because currently we have health plans that have high deductibles. And when you have rising deductibles, the patients are going to be more sensitive to the costs. And I think the cost of medical care and the cost of drugs in general is tremendously opaque to patients. So to answer your question, yes, I think price transparency is tremendously important. Even as a physician, sometimes when I order a test, I'm not able to give a straight answer as to how much the test costs because it's based on where it's done. It's based on the patient's insurer. And there are so many variables involved with that. And patients are now having deductible plans with $5,000, $7,500, $10,000 deductibles, and they're going to be sensitive to these costs. So as long as we have high deductible plans, then price transparency needs to be much better improved. Now, going forward, depending on the next election, the question of whether we continue with high deductible plans will certainly be, is certainly not assured. But speaking today in 2019, we need to do a much better job in being transparent with our prices. Hospitals need to do a better job informing patients of how much things cost, and so do pharmacies and health insurers in terms of drugs, in terms of how much these things cost, because a lot of times patients aren't going to know how much their medical care costs unless it comes in a bill a few months later.
And let me ask you a different question. How do you manage still clinical practice with all the other things that you do in terms of informing and educating the country about what's going on in healthcare? How do you manage to do both those things?
It's certainly a challenge. I don't practice full-time clinical medicine. I practice about three-quarters time, so that's about 3.5 days a week. And that gives me a lot of time to work on my site and to expand the platform and really collect the stories and voices of the thousands of other healthcare professionals who contribute to my site and share stories. So it's given me an opportunity not only to hear from a lot of people, but also to give me better balance, because if I, I'm a primary care physician and it's pretty demanding. And I think if I were to do it full time, I'd probably be prone to burnout as half of primary care doctors are. So having Kevin MD is a tremendous blessing in terms of the variety it gives me in my professional life, but also give me the opportunity to share the stories that I think are often behind closed doors or behind a curtain that I think the public really deserves to see, because our healthcare system is constantly evolving and the public needs to know what's going on behind the scenes. And I'm glad to play a small role in doing that.
Well, you do an unbelievable job of it. It's literally amazing. A different question. What are your thoughts on Medicare for All, public option, et cetera? It partly goes into your discussion earlier of access. Some of your thoughts on that.
So the question of Medicare for All or public option, and I know that this is a tremendously important topic on the progressive and Democratic side, and we're hearing a lot of this in the Democratic primary debates. So the question is really, how do we cover the remaining 20 million people with health insurance? And I think there are many ways of doing so. If some were to start a healthcare system from scratch, I'm sure a lot of people would choose a single-payer system like Medicare for All, because it does have tremendous advantages. So the question is, do we want to fight for an ideal, or do we want to fight for what's pragmatic? I think in our country, the private healthcare insurance system is so entrenched, and this is literally hundreds of billions of dollar industry, and that's not something that's going to go away. So I think it's probably easier to do it incrementally. For instance, with a public option, that's certainly one option that's being floated around. But I think that we need to look for other countries that have a good hybrid of a private and public option to cover their constituents. So if you look at systems like Australia, if you look at systems like Germany or Switzerland, these are not single-payer countries, yet rank very highly on most international scales. So I do think that we need to come up with a solution that incorporates the private health insurance industry. Perhaps they're better regulated. I'm partial to Australia's system. In Australia, the government provides a baseline level of care, and the constituents are able to purchase private health care insurance on top of that to give them better access to care. That certainly is an option that's worth looking into. Candidates who really are talking about Medicare for All or nothing, while I think that you know, there are merits to that when designing a healthcare system from scratch. Unfortunately, the United States isn't in that position. So how do we get from here to there? I think introducing some type of public option or doing it incrementally is probably the most feasible way of doing so.
Thank you. It's always amazing for me to listen to what you have to say, because it's crazily thoughtful and not partisan one way or the other, and just highly analytical in terms of how you approach things. Next question. You mentioned, you sort of answered my next question partly. It's like, how do you look at the U.S. system versus other health systems? Maybe we could ask that more directly. How do you compare the U.S. health system to other systems?
Most international surveys that are being cited ranks the U.S. health system relatively low. Right now, I'm looking at the Commonwealth Fund rankings of the international healthcare systems, and out of 11 countries, the U.S. ranks 11th out of 11 countries. But I think that there are some strengths, as I said, of the U.S. healthcare system. I do think access to specialist care is a strength. I think that we do have access to some of the best specialists in the world. We do have access to specialized diagnostic treatments, things like MRIs. It's easier to get in the United States versus a country like Canada. So I do think that we do have some strengths, but we're paying for it because we spend significantly more than other countries when it comes to our healthcare, and the outcomes isn't as good. So while we do have advantages in terms of access to specialist care and access to specialized equipment and diagnostic tests, I think that our money can be used even better than it is, because if we spend that much money and it's used better than it is now, there's no doubt in my mind that the United States can be the best healthcare system in the world.
You've mentioned access as having to be fixed to really get to cost and quality. How do you fix healthcare in America? What does a fix look like?
Boy, how long do you have, Scott? How would I fix healthcare? Such a frog. But I think I would start. I'm a primary care physician, so I would start with primary care. I've mentioned several times in this podcast about how strong our specialist care is. But on the flip side, I think our primary care is weaker compared to other countries. If you look at a country like the United Kingdom, approximately 70% of their clinicians are primary care and 30% are specialists. But if you look at that ratio in the United States, that's reversed. About, there's a minority of clinicians that are going to primary care. So I do think that we need to strengthen our primary care system. So I have three suggestions on how to do that. The first would be to incentivize physicians to go into primary care. So we need to tackle the cost of medical education, because these physicians are graduating with literally hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, and a primary care profession isn't necessarily going to pay back that debt. Number two, we need to reduce the disparities when it comes to primary care and specialist pay. I think that we have a lot of incentives to do procedures, and I think we need to change the physician payment system so we incentivize cognitive thinking. We need to incentivize thinking in primary care and reverse those incentives that funnel students into specialist care. And the third piece is physician burnout. I think we need to keep our current primary care physicians from burning out. 50% of physicians experience symptoms of burnout, and I think that goes back to how physicians are paid. We're being paid not only by incentivizing procedures, but we're also being paid by incentivizing quantity. Doctors get paid more for seeing more patients. And I think that's tremendously stressful over the long run. So if we change those incentives to better emphasize care, to spend time with patients, to communicate with patients, I think that's not only better from a patient standpoint, but I also think it's better from a physician wellness standpoint, because that's really the reason why a lot of doctors go into medicine.
Thank you. And so if the one thing that you would say is that we need to add more primary care physicians, and the incentives to go into primary care versus specialties make it hard for people economically, lifestyle-wise, to choose to be a primary care physician today, is can a lot of the work be done by not so much primary care physicians, or is there room for physician extenders, for PAs, especially in rural communities where you just can't seem to get enough primary care physicians, or in tougher communities? Are there other answers to it or not really?
No, I do think that there are. There's definitely room for advanced practitioners, such as nurse practitioners and physician assistants. I think that they do a tremendous job with what they do. But I think factually, physicians have, they're in school longer, do more rigorous residencies. And I think there are things that physicians can do that advanced practitioners can't. So I think in a team setting, I think advanced practitioners are tremendously indispensable. But I think I also want to point out that the same incentives that drives physicians into specialty care also apply to advanced practitioners. So you're also seeing a lot of advanced practitioners also go into specialties like dermatology and orthopedic surgery and anesthesiology, and they're also going to specialist care because the same things that are driving how clinicians are being paid also applies to them as well. So to answer your question, I do think that there is definitely a role for advanced practitioners to help with the primary care shortage. But if we don't change the underlying incentives, what we're seeing in the physician community, in the physician profession, is also going to apply to nurse practitioners and physician assistants as well.
Right, because even there, you see more and more of those wanting to jump into PAs, but in specialties because the pay is better. You see, everybody wants to be a cardiological or cardiovascular PA or orthopedic PA. And so even there, you've got the skewed incentives that cause you the kinds of troubles you're talking about.
That's correct. I think I'm seeing more and more physician assistants skipping primary care altogether and going into things like dermatology and cardiology and specialists because the pay is simply better. And also the lifestyle is better too, because the underlying payment system that incentivizes procedures over thinking and doing primary care are still there.
Now, are you saying that the incentives are skewed against thinking and more towards proceduralists? So do you think that proceduralists don't really think?
Absolutely not. You're going to get me into trouble, Scott. No, I think proceduralists...
I'm just kidding. No, we're kidding, of course. But Kevin, it is just a pleasure visiting with you. I know we've had you speak at one of our conferences recently. We'd love to have you back again. I'll get with you on that separately. You're just a fantastic presenter and thinker, an unusually gifted person. How can people reach you or follow you if they want to follow Kevin MD?
Yep, so I'm at kevinmd.com, and that's really my hub in terms of what I do. And you're more than welcome to share to read the many stories that are posted there from healthcare professionals across the spectrum. I post anywhere from 5 to 6 times per day. And there's contact information on that site, kevinmd.com.
Kevin, I want to thank you for your time today. Just a great pleasure visiting with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Scott.